build a high-performing culture? This is Culture Architects. Candid conversations with extraordinary leaders sharing their biggest successes, failures, and lessons learned on their culture journeys. Here's David J. Friedman.
Welcome back to my conversation with Anson Dorrance, the wildly successful women's soccer coach at the University of North Carolina. In our first conversation, we talked about the team culture that Anson created based on fierce competition, continuous evaluation, and his core values. This legendary team culture is known as the competitive cauldron. In today's episode, we're going to hear Anson's thoughts on recruiting and the process by which players are evaluated, not just by their skill on the field, but by their character. Let's listen in.
Obviously, you know, you have built in a very intentional and systematic way the, you know, you called it the competitive cauldron, the kind of culture that would lead to the things that are important to you. From a recruiting standpoint, obviously some women would be a great fit in that, and some of them, you know, they might be great players, they might be great people, but they wouldn't necessarily be a fit in the culture that you've created. And we talk about this in companies all the time, that, you know, as we're recruiting employees to come into a particular company, there could be wonderful people, wonderful human beings who just wouldn't be a fit in that culture. How do you, in your recruiting process, assess, so who would fit in the UNC culture?
David, I'll be completely honest with you. We don't have a really good system for solving that. Because obviously I don't have these kids take a psychological profile to see if they'd fit within the culture. I remember the old Dean Smith stories about the way he would decide on a recruit. And back in the old days, when kids made decisions in their senior year, he would go visit them and he would sit down with the kid and the family and he would see if how the kid treated his parents. And then Dean Smith would make a decision on the kid based on basically the kid's respect for authority, but also the kid's relationship with a mom and dad. And if the kid were just this spoiled brat, he wouldn't recruit them. If the kid, you know, treated his parents poorly, he wouldn't recruit them, because here's what he knew. The way he treats his parents is the way he's going to treat me. And if he has no respect for his parents, he's certainly going to have no respect for me. And so he had this system of picking basically, principle-centered young men. And what a wonderful way to do it. You know, how does this kid treat his parents? We don't have that, because now our kids are making decisions so early, we don't even know them yet. And a part of that is the competition for the elite player. Because holy cow, did we learn our lesson the hard way? Because I was still relatively old school during this transition between when the kids were making really early decisions and kids, you know, making late decisions, which is what I was used to. And so I learned this lesson, because the dilemma for me is when a kid visits us, he's also probably interested in Duke and Virginia as well. These are comparable schools. These are good schools academically. And the trouble with us, if a kid comes onto my campus and I don't offer this kid, because they've set the visit up in advance, is off to Duke. Duke is, you know what, 8 to 10 miles away. So they're off to Duke for the next day. And then Duke offers. It doesn't matter how I try to recover. Even if I come back a month or two later with a full scholarship, after I've vetted the kid more or less, we've lost her. Why? Because you know how it works out.
You know, you've got to make fast decisions.
Yeah. Yeah. So bang, now a kid comes in. I've got to decide when the kid's visiting me, even though I haven't vetted her fully. I haven't even vetted her fully as a soccer player. And now I've got to figure out a way to vet her as a human being. There is no way. So let me share this. And this is genuine, David. In the old days, in a 5-player recruiting class, because I was making late decisions on kids, like into their late junior year, senior year, you know, one out of those 5 kids, or 2 of those 5 kids was much better than I thought. 2 of those 5 kids were about what I thought. 1 kid wasn't as good as I thought. So I would have an 80% hit rate out of the 5 kids coming in. 4 were going to get on the field for me. Now, listen to what the way this works now. Now, yeah, 1 kid is better than I thought. 2 kids are about what I thought. 1 kid is worse than I thought. And the 5th kid is so bad, they don't even make the travel roster. So now I've gone from an 80% hit rate, and you're in the business world, so you understand this. I dropped from 80 to 60. That's a disaster. And the reason it's a disaster is because I can't vet them enough because they're making decisions so early. But out of fear of having to play against the kid at Duke or Virginia, I am just making an offer and then just, I'm three sheets to the wind. Okay, let's keep our fingers crossed and see what happens when they come in. And then what we're trying to do is we're trying to reconstruct this athlete, which gets us to the third point that we talk about in our culture, which is we call this changing the personal narrative to the truth. And this is our challenge. Now we're trying to get a kid that we didn't fully vet that's coming into the program. And now a part of my construction of them in this player conference is to try to get their personal narrative to the truth, because every kid has a personal narrative that's designed to protect them from pain and accountability. Who built this narrative? It's usually the parents. And usually the parents have no idea on how to construct a human being. And they've all, you know, succumbed to the self-esteem movement, which is this movement where, you know, just praise your kids. Praise them for no reason. Give them this feeling that they're, you know, invincible, and then they're going to conquer the world. And of course, what ends up happening when you do that is, first of all, your kid has no standards, because it's like, you know, everyone gets a trophy. So yeah, your kid has no standards because you haven't set a standard for them. Everything they've done is great. I'm trying to protect their, you know, their fragile self-esteem. So, you know, they don't have any standards. But also the other thing that ruins them, and ruins them for me, they have no respect for authority. Why? Because these kids know their parents have done nothing but BS them their entire lives. And so they think every authority figure is full of garbage because of the way they were raised. So now all of a sudden these people come into my environment and all of a sudden we've got standards. And no, it's the old thing that we brought this sociologist in 2012. And my AD is fabulous. Every 5 years he brings in the resident expert on who we're recruiting, you know, the millennials and then the Gen Zs. So he's telling us who these people are. So in 2012, I guess he's talking about the millennials. I loved it. His first two slides were all I had to look at. He said, all right, here's the generation you're dealing with now. And I loved it because of the slides. The first slide had on top of it 1969. That's perfect. That's the year I graduated high school. I'm very comfortable remembering those wonderful years when I graduated from high school. Here's the first slide. Kid's coming home from school. He's got all Fs on his report card. The parents are screaming at the kid. Now the date has changed to the date he's giving a lecture, which is 2012. Kid comes home from school, all Fs on his report card, and the parents are screaming at the teacher. So now nothing is the kid's fault anymore. Nothing is the kid's fault. I mean, it's like that, you know, scandal where, you know, parents were buying their kids into Stanford and the University of Southern California. And it's like, you know, the kid didn't have to have a standard. The parent was going to take care of them. And of course, we've all heard about the helicopter parent. Well, this was the evolution to the snowplow parent. Mm-hmm. The helicopter parent, you know, hovered over the kid and made sure they didn't make any bad choices. The snowplow parent is pushing every single obstacle out of the way. Their kid never sees an obstacle with the snowplow parent. So that's where we are now. So basically, that's the kid that we're training. The kid we're training right now is a kid whose background hasn't prepared them. Now, fortunately for me, every now and again, I end up with two parents that have it right. They have it right. They send me this kid that basically has, you know, a principal center, understands what standards are, you know, is willing to compete and not be given things. And obviously, in my environment with the cauldron, everything is a matter of public record. So all of a sudden, you know, everything that was hidden before is now exposed. And if they're fragile, holy cow, it's just going to be difficult for them, because now everything is on a bulletin board in 28 different categories. You're going to be ranked somewhere from, you know, 1 to 30. It's public. And boy, are they in trouble if I'm writing a book that year. Is that going into the book? Because, of course, Al's mom, Gloria, wrote one of my books with me. So all of a sudden that stuff's in the book. So this is a transition period that's difficult for these people, but that's my next challenge when they get here. My next challenge is, can I take their personal narrative to the truth? And some kids, they can navigate it. It's not easy. And now they've got to get separate from their parents' opinions of them. Now they're on their own. Their parent can't save them. The parent can't call me up. And obviously parents have tried this. I remember one parent.
I suspect that doesn't work well.
Well, no, it doesn't work well. But one parent, it was hilarious. One parent blamed me for basically the fact their kid never played because it was my job to inspire them. And clearly, since I didn't inspire them, it was my fault. I mean, I was just incredulous, you know, the responsibility I had for their kids. So I just didn't get it. So anyway, so there you have it.
That's great. So let me ask you one last question. You know, you've had many players over the years, and you've spent so much effort, clearly, and so much passion around character development and building the kind of young women who are, you know, have strength of personality and that which should serve them well. So tell me about, you know, as you look now at some of the people you've had for many years, you've been at it for 45 years. You've had a lot of people who've graduated from your program and moved on to do other things in their lives. What are some of the things that you're most proud of that you see that they learned from their time, you know, in your cauldron?
Well, what I absolutely love, obviously, from one perspective, because we recruit with it, is right after we won the 2019 World Championship, one of the color commentators came on who had clearly done the math and said, you know what, of the four World Championship teams in the United States, one out of three players were trained at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. I'm listening to this, and of course, my ego is soaring like a hawk, listening to this person that had done the work. And of course, we had never even done the work, but all of a sudden this comes out, you know, on the air, and all of a sudden, you know, one out of three players in the four World Championship teams are trained right here. I felt incredible because obviously, you know, we recruit with that. The other things, David, are they're not as sexy to recruit with. And so honestly, we don't really talk about the core values with the parents. I did give a speech at the What Drives Winning conference called Grading Character. Every now and again, I will guide a family to listen to it because in that talk, they can see the thing that I value. And I talk about Amos Alonzo Stagg. I talk about what my real mission is. And my real mission is that. My real mission is character development under the guise of us getting together, you know, trying to become extraordinary soccer players. But for me, I see these kids all the time and they come back to campus and I love seeing them. They connect with me on a consistent basis. One of my favorites is the father of one of my kids on the U.S. full team now. And almost every time she plays in a full team game, I get a note from the dad that really thanks me for helping his daughter navigate the world. And it's not just her soccer development. Mm-hmm. The note I get back from him is about who she is as a young woman. And he really appreciates that because we're all different. These notes are things I absolutely cherish. And Melissa knows this because this drives her crazy. My wife, we'll be watching a TV show at night and I am clearing text messages and emails and it just drives her crazy. Like I can't close down. These are my kids. If one of them sends me something, I am responding and I'm responding as soon as possible. And it's just the nature of my connection with all of them. And so, they lead extraordinary lives. I mean, look at your niece. She's a general manager now. Are you freaking kidding me? I mean, she is climbing the ladder, the president of U.S. soccer, the most powerful soccer position in the United States is Cindy Parlow. That's one of my kids. She lives right here in Chapel Hill. But they all achieve amazing things. We had a recruit on campus yesterday she's from Charlotte and her mother played for me. And this kid, I think is going to end up coming to play for me, even though I've told her you're never going to get on the field for a minute. You're never going to play, you know, in 4 years. And yet she's still going to come. And I said, listen, visit the other schools, all these schools that you're being offered scholarship money for, visit them because it's going to be very hard for you to get on the field. The mother loved it here so much. She almost won't let her daughter go anywhere else, even though we're not offering her a scholarship and it's going to be hard for her to get on the field as a player. And what was absolutely fabulous is all of a sudden her husband, both her lawyers, by the way, her husband hired one of my kids. Which kid did he hire? He hired basically a UNC graduate that is a world champion. It was a world champion in 2015 that finished law school at Wake Forest, married a Tar Heel lacrosse player. They now live in Charlotte. And he was telling me on this visit the other day, what an extraordinary employee she is because she's on his She's on his team. They're a private equity division in this law firm. And I absolutely loved it. And I said, do you mind sending me a note to that effect? Because I would love to e-blast this out. Because we have this thing we send that every week or so, bragging about all of our kids. And obviously, it's a recruiting platform. We send it to our players, certainly, the parents of our players, but also our recruits, our alumni, our donors. And it's basically a brag sheet of whatever one of my kids has just done that was extraordinary. Like I just saw that Crystal Dunn was all CONCACAF because of how she played in the Olympics and everything else. And so I'm just so proud of her. So we're e-blasting out something about Crystal Dunn. But I would love for this guy to write a sort of a review of how this young Tar Heel lawyer is doing, because he was bragging about her. And I said, you know, do you mind putting that in writing and just send it to me? Because I want to send that out to the world. And, you know, we brag about all these kids. I mean, this kid I'm having breakfast with on Monday, her older sister played for me, signed a pro contract when she graduated, got a degree in public health, went to Harvard Medical School. That wasn't enough. Got an MBA from Stanford right after that. And this, I joke about this all the time. I'm dying for this woman to run the Center for Disease Control. She's an amazing leader. I know if she was there, the CDC would be trying to keep us all alive rather than, you know, align with different political factions and decide whether to keep us alive, because she's too strong to put up with some, you know, political martinet that's going to tell her what to do. No. She won't listen. She's too smart for, you know, the political battles that are out there. And so I love these kids because they have principal centers and I'm proud of them. And yeah, I brag about these kids all the time. And and I joke about this now because I still tell the Amos Alonzo Stagg story. I can't use that anymore because, of course, I'm going to be dead in 20 years. So I've got to use a different sort of story. But yeah, I see these kids and they ascend. And it's not just in the football world. These are remarkable women and they get a great education here, and they are principle-centered. I'm very proud of all of them, David.
That's great. That's great. Well, I really appreciate your wisdom, Anson. Obviously, we could talk for about four more hours about this, it's fascinating. In particular, I think what stands out to me most, and I hope for our listeners as well, is in particular the principle-centered aspect of this. Yes, you built championships after championships after championships, but you built human beings who go on to be, you know, special human beings in the world. And clearly, you know, that doesn't happen by accident. There's a quote that's in my last book that I think is as applicable to what you've done as it is to business. And the quote that I often share is I say that good companies have good cultures by chance, but world-class companies have world-class cultures by design. And what I hear and what you've done is the same thing, that, you know, great championship teams and great programs, and I'll say programs more than just, because a program's more than just whether you won on the field or not, but great programs, you know, good programs do it by accident, which is how you were at the beginning before you watched Dean Smith. But the great ones, it's intentional, it's systematic, it's purposeful. This isn't by accident, which is really why I call this whole podcast Culture Architects, because it's about people who've purposely, like you said, we're not leaving this to chance. We are purposeful and systematic about creating what we want to create. So again, I really appreciate you sharing your wisdom with us. I know it'll be really valuable for our audience. So thanks so much, Anson.
David, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I appreciated the conversation, so thank you.
And that's it for this episode of Culture Architects with my fellow culture architect, Anson Dorrance. If you're enjoying the show, make sure you take a second to subscribe so you automatically get my new shows when they drop. Also, if you have a minute, I'd love it if you left us a review so more folks like you can discover the show. I'll see you next time on Culture Architects.
This has been Culture Architects with David J. Friedman. Join us next time for more insights and wisdom from great leaders in all walks of life. To book David for your next event or to learn more about his writing, speaking, or consulting, go to davidjfriedman.com. Culture Architects with David J. Friedman is a production of CultureWise.